Welcome to Chapters in Tattoo History. I started tattooing split between Manhattan and Connecticut in the 1980s, and I opened my own shop in New Jersey in 1991. So I find the heritage, creativity, and rebelliousness of this ever-changing business very captivating. It's a lifelong passion for me, almost as much as music. So during this series, I'll be presenting one-on-one interviews with tattoo figures, and we'll see how it goes. Today's guest is Lal Hardy, revered London tattooist who is probably the artist most closely associated with the punk subculture. Our conversation talks about his legacy, some London tattoo history, and we delve into what might be the future of tattooing. Direct from Muswell Hill in London, it's Lal Hardy.
My interest in tattooing was probably initially sparked by members of my family who'd been in the Navy or the military who had tattoos. And also, as being a child, they used to sell these lick and stick tattoos that were designed by Tattoo Ollie in Denmark. So as kids, you know, you'd want to look like your uncle and put these ships on or whatever were in the bubblegum packets, you know. So from being a kid, seeing the tattoos on my family that had been in the military and Navy was probably the initial start for it. And then in the UK, in the mid-1970s, there was a huge Teddy Boy and rock and roll revival. It was seriously as big as punk, but probably not as reported because it didn't have the same shock value. But in Britain of the 70s, every pub had a music room in it. So it was every night of the week you could go to a different pub, there'd be a rock and roll band playing. And these Teddy Boys had tattoos, but because they wore drape suits, a lot of them had visible tattoos on their hands or neck. So you would see these and you know, when you're young, and you're into your whatever you're into, whatever music scene or subculture. When I saw these guys, they just looked so smart. Their clothing was so different to the flared trousers and that people were wearing. They're wearing drain pipes and creepers. I started going to lots of rock and roll clubs, and then I started to see these guys with their tattoos. And that led me to getting a tattoo off of a Teddy Boy called Dave Cash in 1976. And I'd been drawing tattoos, and then I just realised that it was just something that I really wanted to do. I managed to get some equipment. Wasn't very good, but it was a start. And then there was the crossover period of, if you look at the sort of mid to late 70s, we had glam rock, we had punk rock, we had new wave, we had, you know, the biggest selling band was ABBA. There was disco. There was everything happened. But in the subculture scene, especially in London, we had rockabilly, rock and roll, punk, psychobilly. I was going to all these different clubs, meeting all these different people. And just the fashions, the attitude, the energy, everything was just absolutely just amazing. And I realised that these were all markets that could be tapped into, but all markets that I loved, all different clubs and places. So I was going to gigs, nightclubs, pubs and that, and there weren't many tattoo artists around at the time. I always had a pocket full of business cards that I'd give out to people. And really, that's how it all started. And a magazine called Punk Rock had come out. And one of the things that I've realised in my early days of tattooing is, if you wait for publicity, you can wait a long time. So I started to write to magazines, all different sorts of magazines, just saying, hey, listen, I'm a tattoo artist. Always write to the features editor and say, if you'd like to do a feature on tattooing, you know, this is some photos of what I do. So many of those features editors got in touch with me because you've done the work for them, haven't you? You found a thing that's going to fill a few pages for them. But a magazine called Punk's Not Dead did a big double page colour spread. It was just mad. I had punks coming from everywhere to get tattooed in. And as you can see from where we are, we're not on the main road. We're not in the main part of London. Yeah, it was just totally amazing.
So how long have you had this shop in this location?
I've been in this location for 42 years. A lifetime.
What was your skill level like when the punk scene and the Ted scene tattoo skill?
My tattoo skill level was probably on a scale of 1 to 10, 2 or 3 initially. When I got my first kit, I didn't know how you made needles. I didn't know how you mixed colours. And then gradually I started to learn little bits and pieces and get a bit more confident. Then in 1978, I had an altercation in a nightclub that ended up with a fight where I got the tendons in my hand severed. So I couldn't tattoo for a while, and I popped in to see this old-timer called Jock in King's Cross. And I said to him, oh, you know, he said, what have you done to your hand? I explained, and I said, you know, I used to do a bit of tattooing. And he said, well, if you get the use of your hand back, come and work here. It really, the hygiene and everything about that shop was poor, but it was a massive, massive learning curve. I mean, to be in an old-timer shop in a pretty rough area of London, lots of sort of alcoholics, junkies, prostitutes, a lot of violence. I learned quite a bit about running a business, about how you deal with people through being in jocks. And then I met Dennis Cockle. And Dennis, to a degree, he took me under his wing. He did want me to do an apprenticeship with him, but the money that he wanted at the time seemed extortionate, but probably it wouldn't have been as an investment anyway. Long story short, I went my own way with it. And then Dennis introduced me to Ed Hardy, and that was probably the single most, I'd say, meeting Ed Hardy and meeting Ian of Reading, who was a fantastic British tattooist. I think those two people showed what you could achieve in tattooing, and they were just both absolutely inspirational. And I mean, Ed, you know, you get people who say, oh, he sold out, he did the Ed Hardy clothing range. It's like, fuck off. Look at what he did before that. And so what if he did a clothing range? He did so much for the tattoo world. He was just so influential and gave so willingly of information, promoted people. I did an article for the Music and Sea edition of Tattoo Time as well. And I think having the opportunity to be in that, and it did go to a much bigger audience, that helped because I started to meet more and more people. I mean, nowadays you can do apprenticeships, and I know they're few and far between proper ones, but you can get people who show you everything. But back then, it was such a trial and error way of going about things. But it was interesting, and, you know, even today, I'm still learning all the time. I think that's the important thing in the tattoo world, is to sometimes embrace new technologies. You know, lots of people don't like pens, they don't like iPads. They go on about the old timers. Well, you know, maybe if iPads were around in Jerry's time, Sailor Jerry might have had one, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it does make things easier.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
So I'm wondering about the kind of flash. Like, when punk was really in its explosive stage and you were tattooing, was it more like you were making things up or people were coming to you with designs? Because the idea that I get is that it was a different way of looking at art and a different reason for getting tattooed, possibly.
I think that the first wave of punk wasn't as tattoo-inspired as the second wave.
Oh, okay.
So I think by the time we'd got to probably 1980, 81, mm-hmm. 82, the Mohicans, the brightly coloured hair, it had actually become more of a uniform, more recognisable than the very early punk. And those guys really embraced the tattoo scene. And I would look at, say, a picture of a woman and just think, well, you know, she'd look better with a mohawk or a Catwoman haircut. So I drew my flash like that. You had lots of fanzines, lots of record covers that were designed by punks, for punks, the painted leather jacket. So it was quite an artistic time. You know, when you actually look at different subcultures that have existed, punk was probably the most artistic of them all, because if you look at the Teddy Boys, they had their suits made. The skinheads, they bought their stuff, was ready-made. But punks were making their stuff, painting their own jackets, painting their own record covers, you know, making their own fanzines. So there was a wealth of inspiration out there. And people would bring, you know, their own artwork with them. They bring record covers, they get stuff off of my flash. So the artwork was coming in from all different angles.
You can almost tell that that's the way that time was.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I always say to everyone, it was more of an energy and an atmosphere. I don't know, I just loved the look of the people, especially, you know, the girls. I don't say that in a misogynistic way. It was just like the way that they did their hair, their makeup and everything. Mm-hmm. It was just amazing, you know. And at a time when, as we say, you know, disco was a big height, and the kind of different opposites that were around, it was quite strange, really.
When I think of punk in the UK and the look, I think of Lal Hardy. That's the name that I know in terms of being associated with, whether it was punk bands. I remember seeing pictures of you tattooing Becky Bondage from Vice Squad, and then the woman who had the mohawk, who had the beautiful tribal on her.
I mean, everything that came along, I think that sometimes in tattooing you can be in the right place or at the right time, or you can seize an opportunity or a combination of all of those things. And I mean, Adi, the girl who had the tattoo on the side of her head, I'd gone to America, met Leo Zulueta, and, you know, of course, he was quite big in the San Francisco punk scene. He was doing a lot of flyers and covers and stuff, and he gave me a book of Iban Borneo tribal designs, and Adi looked through it and she just said, would you tattoo that on my head? At the same time as I did that, there were a few photographers in London that were documenting the tattoo scene. And, you know, Adi was so striking looking, and to have, I mean, nowadays you wouldn't look twice at a woman with a red mohawk and a tattoo on her head, you know, because tattooing is so mainstream. But back then, people just went wild on it. You know, they just went absolutely crazy for that. And I guess of all the stuff I've ever done, that's probably the one piece that people would associate you with. Once again, it was just being in the right place, right time, right design. Everything fell into place, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can still remember it so vividly to this day. How much tattooing were you doing when you decided to actually open this shop?
So when I first started tattooing, I used to work as what we call a dustman. I mean, in America, you could probably call it the trash man or the garbage man. So what that allowed me to do was, that was called job and finish. So the earlier you went to work, the earlier you could finish. So I'd go out to work at 6 o'clock in the morning, pull all the trash cans onto the street for the other guys. They'd just drive along with the lorry, throw them on, job would be finished, which meant that my tax was paid and I had a guaranteed income. And then before I had this shop, I tattooed out of where I lived, a little bedsitter flat that I had. And then I got this shop, so I would open in the afternoon. So I was tattooing pretty much every day and working every day. But that's just the way it was then. And when we were talking earlier about that new book, The Pioneers of British Tattooing, when I was reading the hours that the tattoo artist worked in the 1900s, the early 1900s, you know, right up 1910, 20, 30, it's all before the age of television. So people had much more time to make use of. Now we just sit in front of the television, the drug of the nation. It's very easy to just sit in front of the telly. But, you know, back then, there seemed to be so many hours in the day. You know, it wouldn't matter if you tattooed till 11 o'clock at night. It's pretty crazy.
So what were the hours in general?
So I would normally work, say, open the shop at 12 o'clock till 6, but if you had to stay longer, you'd stay longer, you know? I mean, in the winter it was hard, but it was still very seasonal, a seasonal trade.
Yes.
In the early days. And people didn't work by appointment, you know? I can remember a friend of mine, you say you come from New Jersey, a guy I know went to Hailden to get tattooed by Shotzi Gorman.
Oh, yeah.
And he said to me, I had to make an appointment. And it was like, what the fuck's an appointment, you know? Because it was just all walking for us, you know? And the old-timers would tell you great stories about one guy on a Saturday. There were so many people waiting that he would put the stencil on them, take the money, that to sit in the shop and just wait their turn.
You know,
with a stencil ready.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Keep everybody there.
Yeah.
Was that one guy you?
No. No, it was a guy in...
I wouldn't hold it against you.
I think it's a really good idea.
Has the European ink standards, has it affected you? Do you know about what's going on over there?
It hasn't affected us, and the wording for the reach, you know, the documentation that led to everything seems quite ambiguous. On a personal level, you know, I find it quite strange that we live in a society that will sell alcohol and tobacco products that are known to be addictive, that are known to cause cancer, heart disease, lung disease, that cause so many problems. And, you know, they head for the tattoo trade. That's because in society now we've got people who've got jobs who their job is just to try and fucking make life difficult for others. I mean, I know tattooists that have got bottles of colour that they've had for years and years and years, you know, and it's the same as the tattoo world has become a very environmentally unfriendly world and a very throwaway world. I mean, you get your blister packs of needles and they've got an expiry date and people throw them away. Well, we've got an autoclave, so just put them through the autoclave. You know, everything is plastic.
Do you know anybody in Europe that it's really affected? Like, I don't know that many European artists.
Well, I'm not really expert to talk on that. I think that probably people have found ways around it. And, you know, the thing is, if they continue to put restrictions upon tattooing, it will just drive it underground. Yes. And once something's underground, it's impossible to control. You know, for this studio, our environmental health licensing, we have to go through, you know, strict procedure for everything. And one of the funny things is we have to pay for our license, we have to pay for it to be issued, we have to pay for this, that, we have to have this special clinical waste, we have to do... But if I worked at my house, I don't need any licensing from... I could tell the council I'm working at my house and they don't impose any restrictions on you, and yet a legitimate business deemed to be one that they've got so many restrictions on. It's quite strange.
Has licensing been a thing ever since you started tattooing?
Yeah.
It has. Wow.
Yeah.
When you started, when you opened New Wave, how many other tattoo shops were in London? Approximately.
20. And now there's probably 20 on Camden High Street.
Which means how many in London?
Hundreds. But that being said, some established ones are closing down. Others open up. Some come along. You know, I've seen lots of shops come and go. This shop, I got the opportunity to buy it, so I bought the shop, which is probably one of the few people in London who owns their shop, which makes life quite a bit easier in relation to not having to deal with landlords and leases, because some of the landlords, they see a successful business and then they want to really up all the rents. You know, tattooists and the tattoo world, sometimes it's quite a fine balance between running a successful business and then being outpriced.
Yeah. I remember tattooing people years ago and people going, look at that machine, that's crazy looking. And I remember saying to them, yeah, but the tattoo industry isn't big enough to make something sleek and good for my hand. It's just not that large enough, and now it is.
Yeah.
And I've never used a pen. I really stopped tattooing in 2009, and then I was tattooing friends up until, you know, 2017, and I just didn't want to buy anything else. I mean, it looks like it's light. It looks like it's...
Yeah, I don't mind using them. I don't mind using the pen or a coil machine. I quite like the pens because they make you lazy in a way, because you just click a different cartridge in, and that makes life so much easier than having to either set up, you know, you can have one pen and 10 cartridges, or you can have 10 machines set up.
Right.
But it's funny because the other day I came in and I had a guy called Joseph Pineda working here. He's from America. He's a fantastic tattoo artist and he makes machines, and I was watching him using a coil and I just thought, wow, you're doing such great work with that. The sound of it's great, that I just thought, go back to them. But that's one of the great things about tattooing. The more things you learn to use, you can drop them out and then return to them. You know, at one time in this country, everything initially was done with a liner and a round shader or a spread round shader. Then in the late 1970s, we started to use a lot of three liners and six flats. People were using six flats a real lot. And then when I met Ed, Ed and Dennis were both showing me magnums, you know. We'd never seen them before, and then it was like, wow. And, you know, that's one of the other things, when you used to make your own needles as well. It's nowadays the...
But do you really miss that?
I don't miss it. The only thing I will say is that some of the ready-made needles, the inconsistency in quality and the gauge of a lot of the needles is way too fine. And also, the other confusing thing is how they label them now. When I started tattooing, you just had liners. You had a 3, 5, 7, or you had a Magnum, you know, 7, 9 or 15. Now it's like SE Mag 1500, and it's like, oh, God's sake, you know.
To have like a translation chart just to see what you're using.
You know, needle hieroglyphics.
Yeah. I remember one time making needles and dropping some solder. I was wearing stockings.
Yeah.
I don't think I would ever miss that. But you're right about, you know, when you need to make a needle, a particular needle for a particular piece, whatever it is, and I would do that all the time, like, I need to set these back or whatever you could. It is really cool that things have advanced, but they haven't necessarily changed.
No. It's interesting. Sometimes I show people how to make needles and they're all like, they have a little go themselves. And I think they feel part of the old way and they feel that they've achieved something because it is an art form in itself.
Oh, yeah. You know. Putting the bar, putting it on the machine itself when you go to tattoo.
Yeah.
Just the amount of tissue and what it, like, that is an art in itself.
For rubber, the sort of rubber grommets, I mean, Dennis Cock always used to have little squares of plaster. Zinc oxide plaster cut into small little squares lined up on a shelf, just hanging off the edge. He would use those as his sort of grommets, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, with tattooing, it's quite funny as well in the old ways. You know, people always used to ask about the humble rubber band, didn't they?
Yeah.
Why have you got a rubber band on there? You know.
What did you tell them? What's the best thing you told them?
I just said to them that, you know, it's there to stop the needle bar pinging off. We'd lie to them about colour. We'd just tell them it was household paint and stuff when they'd ask questions. Or when people used to ask questions years ago, I just used to look at them and say, are you a policeman? Because you keep asking me fucking questions. I want me to help you with your inquiries. You know.
I remember people used to ask, how come it has to make that noise? And I would say, if it was quiet, you would hear the skin ripping.
Yeah. I think years ago you could tease people a little bit more. And because it was a bit of a fear of the unknown, journeying into the unknown, especially walking into a studio with the windows blacked out because you wouldn't know what was beyond that door. And, you know, it was a lot of peer pressure as well, people saying, oh, you know, it's going to kill you and that. I think that we never get anyone faint now, but we used to get loads of people faint back in the day. I think people see so many people getting tattooed now, youngsters to grandmas, and they're fine with being tattooed. So I don't think there's a fear there anymore.
Right, they almost know what to expect.
Yeah.
In a certain period of time, people really came to you and they had no idea. Like, okay, I want a tattoo and I don't know anything about it, and you're going to do it, you're going to show me how it's done. And now people, for the most part, have seen it done, whether it's they've gone with their friends or they've seen it on TV and all that. And I feel like there's a different feeling in a tattoo shop.
In society in general, I think there's a sense of entitlement with a lot of people, or a lot of people feel that their opinion overrides the experience of the practitioner.
Yeah. Now, when somebody wants something super, super, super small that's going to look terrible in 4 months, how does that go?
I've got an album on my phone called Tattoos That Don't Work. So anything I see on the internet where it's a tattoo that hasn't worked, I'll screenshot that and drop it into that album. I will try and advise people. I also say to them, you know, if a tattoo's too small, I just say, look, you wouldn't wear your shoes too small. So why would you do it with a tattoo? But some people are insistent, they know better, they think you're lying. I always say to them, I'm not lying to you, I'm trying to tell you the truth. But some of them just don't care. And, you know, some of the artists doing this work, they peddle the myth to their clients that it is going to be okay. If the person walks away, I mean, we've had people come in, they open up Pinterest and the picture they're showing you is not even a tattoo, it might be a transfer. And trying to convince them that this isn't a tattoo, and they think it is.
That's probably, for me, the most frustrating part of still being in the tattoo business. Oh, are you the official tattooer of Tottenham?
No, but I did at one time tattoo lots and lots of the players, loads of them.
That's pretty awesome.
But, you know, they retire or they move on to other clubs. So, yeah, at one time, some of the people at the club said I was the official tattooist, but it was more just as a bit of a joke, really. But, yeah, and I mean, I've followed them since 1968, so my dad was a Tottenham supporter, my granddad. So, yeah, they've been breaking my heart for years.
I've got a couple of friends in the States that are Tottenham fans. I understand. What's the best, like, Tottenham souvenir that you've ever gotten?
To be honest with you, a few of them sort of gave me shirts and things, but I felt uneasy asking for stuff because quite a few of them, you realise that they're just ordinary people like yourself. I mean, okay, they might be millionaires because of the wage that they get, but, you know, they have the same anxieties as other people. They have the same doubts. They have the same jokes. I never really asked for anything. I used to like it, you know, because I've got a season ticket there. I used to like it after the game sometimes, going and meeting them in the bar, especially if it had been a really good game. But no, there was nothing that I wanted off of them, you know. And it got to the point as well where people kept saying to me, oh, can you get this signed? Can you get that? And in the end, I felt that it could have actually killed my relationship with the players by asking them all the time. So in the end, I just had to say no to everyone and just say no.
Did you ever meet Greg Irons?
Yeah, he was going to tattoo me and
Then,
you know, that accident happened. And
yeah. I was apprenticing for Spider and I was really noticing his work and I've got all of his comics and some of the...
He used to write to me and I sent him some stuff. He sent me, like, No Cure for Cancer, Invasion of the Charlies. I put a letter on Instagram that where he was talking about how could I go and meet him at a convention and different things. But, yeah, he was an immense talent. I can remember that Ed Hardy sent me a postcard to say that he died, and it was like, wow. Which just shows you, because now it would be on Instagram within seconds.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I got it, you know, through a card being sent. So, yeah, I think it left a massive hole in the tattoo world. And, I mean, it would be interesting to see whether Greg remained in tattooing, how his style would have developed, or when you think, you know, he worked on films, he did the comics, he did book illustration, he did tattooing, would he have gone and off in a different direction? Would he have always remained a tattooist? We'll never know that, but when you think for the short period of time that he was actually in the tattoo scene, the sort of influence and innovation of his designs was just crazy.
How do you see the future of tattooing? You've really watched the trajectory go up and down and up and down.
Yeah, I think the future of tattooing, I mean, I think we're seeing some absolutely ridiculous things. Everything is to try and get publicity, you know, these people being completely anaesthetized before being tattooed, people fucking pissing on each other and tattooing over the streaks, people doing anything to get some kind of clickbait on the social media platforms. I think that people will tire of it. I think that even now, looking through Instagram myself, I think, you know, people's attention span becomes less and less. Maybe a lot of future generations aren't going to want to be tattooed, or people that will maybe regret their tattoos might sort of be advocates for not being tattooed. So tattooing will always exist. It always has done and it always will. But I think that there'll be a downturn in it. I think there's a lot of people out there that think that, as my friend was quoted as saying, that the tattoo tree will always bear fruit, and perhaps it won't, you know? I mean, certain styles that are super, super popular, maybe them styles aren't going to be super popular. For somebody who, like myself, who's been in the business, if you take the starting point of doing the sort of teddy boy tattoos, then punk came along. We've had lots of things that have come along between now and then that were sort of trend driven. We've had Celtic work, we've had the Dust Hill Dawn Tribal, we've had Polynesian, Maori work, biomechanical, fantasy work, when people were getting little dolphins done. I mean, the nearest thing to it probably is the pocket watch phenomenon that happened. And in the end, you know, we everything is now there in place. That's why people are doing these, I don't know if it's fair to say ridiculous tattoos or these ignorant style tattoos, because there is a market for it. But when that market changes or dries out, are people going to wish that they'd have had something a little bit more either traditional style or more artistically created? So, you know, I think people will come and go. I think that the business will definitely take a downturn, but it will exist. And for those that are resilient enough to stay in it, they'll find a way to remain in it. In a way, it's like your girlfriend, you know. You've got to look after it, and otherwise they're leaving you. Tattooing, as I said, it's been an absolutely fantastic thing for me. And that's why, you know, I like to try and do the things I do, especially, you know, I use Instagram now for trying to put stuff from the past to do it in a fun way for people so they can look at things. I'm not telling people that you've got to do this or you've got to embrace that, but it's just to show the way things were done. You know, I recently did a talk with a tattoo historian and a tattooist who's been tattooing for 60 years in Scotland. We did a cancer fundraiser for a charity, but we all spoke for probably an hour each. It was really well received by people, you know. There was like, I think there were 38 tattoo shops represented at this evening, and it was just nice. It was really nice to sort of did like a slideshow showing them different things, talking about some of the characters that existed, the quirkiness that existed within those people, and it's nice. I enjoy all of that. I think people come and speak to you afterwards, and sometimes they get maybe a little bit starstruck, and then you have to tell them, hey, listen, I'm just the same as you, an ordinary person. I always have that conversation that you're on the same level with them, and I think people like that. If they want a photo done, sure, have a photo if you want to do this. And words of encouragement are really important. When I see young tattooists, and if they're doing stuff that's amazing, years ago, old timers had never give you encouragement.
Oh, no.
They were like, no. But now I think it's great, you know. And I still get, well, I've not got much space left. I still get tattooed, and had a girl called Clara Welsh tattooed me recently. I absolutely love her stuff. It's really, really different, you know. It was just great to see these young people and to just think, wow, look at what they're doing. Samantha Fung, she's a girl from Hong Kong, tattoos in London now. She just replicates within her own style old school classics that are just like fantastic. It's just her work is amazing, you know. Yeah, so that sort of keeps you, I think, enjoying seeing the good stuff keeps you interested in the trade rather than looking at the negative stuff and focusing on that. And that's the other thing, I never get involved in arguments about what's good and bad on the internet. It's like, yeah, my friend said, getting involved in a fucking discussion on the internet is like deliberately treading in dog shit on the sidewalk. You know?
It is. Especially a negative tattoo discussion.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love your commitment.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's all right.
Thanks so much to Lau for the visit with him, and what a humble, talented, accomplished man. Some people just get it. Check the show notes for images of his studio, New Wave Tattoo in London. The website is newwavetattoo.co.uk. On Facebook, you can check out New Wave Tattoo London, Lau Hardy. On Instagram, New Wave Tattoo. And I would highly suggest following Lau Hardy's individual verified account. He's been on a roll for a while, putting up some really great historical images of his collections and other people's. All right, there you go.